So first thing is, these are all stars. It should have worked better on my iPad, but, and you'll see why, okay? This is not just a simple panel. All of these guys have very, very interesting backgrounds, and you're gonna see why. So first thing is, we wanted to sort of, you know, motivate why this panel. And the way to think of it is that, as you know, the web is mobile. I had a really nice set of presentations to show you, but at least you can see I'm controlling this from a mobile device. And I built the entire presentation that you're seeing here with a mobile device. And I'm not using a web app, I'm using a native app. So that's the point, right? It's going mobile and it's not web-based, or at least not all of it, right? And all of these frameworks are sort of optimized for the constrained device that are constrained in terms of the native set of web apps that you're seeing right now, the native application, sorry. There's also a trend between client-side versus server-side frameworks for web, and that's also creating kind of a shakeup right now. And then finally, HTML5 is coming as the superhero that's gonna solve all the problems, right? And it's still not clear if that's true, but there's certainly a lot of support for HTML5, right? So those are the kind of the motivation. So the theme is really about what's the future of web apps in terms of the frameworks, and what's the mobile story, really? And is it a client-side versus server-side, or is it a hybrid? What's the solution? So let's get the perspective from these the distinguished panel that we have. So first thing is I send them a set of seed questions. So really sort of what's wrong with the current approaches? You know, could you identify some things? And what do we need to fix them? Second thing is from a mobile point of view, Steve Jobs certainly has not only good reasons for pushing native apps, but he also did, with his team, a fantastic job, right? Google is trying to solve this, Microsoft has a solution. So there's native apps. But at the same time, there's mobile web apps. And you know, what's the difference between the two? And can we reduce the gap? The other thing is, there's a new browser war, right? There's lots more opportunities now for differentiation on the browser. And is that an advantage or an issue? And then finally, is HTML5 the holy grail? So let me introduce you to the panel, to the panelists. I think the order is not the order that I have here, but it's the order that I listed on the slides. So I'll start with Patrick. He's an old friend, a French. Merci. And the thing about Patrick to know is that he's a tinkerer, and he hacks around at Google and evangelizes things. So if you ever get a chance to chat with him, you can pretty much ask him anything. The other thing I want to mention is he's unlike a lot of people that I've met that are evangelizing and being completely honest. When Buzz came out, he didn't switch to Buzz, right? So he's not the kind of guy that's going to just push you particular, exactly, and he uses an iPhone. So he will be honest about what he thinks is the right thing. So, you know, he's not gonna push Google down your throat, particularly. So thank you, Patrick, for being here. The next person is Rafi. I just met him, but he's, as you'll see, a superstar. Why is that? Well, first thing is that he breaks things at Twitter. And you heard about the recent iOS integration. That's him, pretty much. And then the other thing, why is he a superstar? Well, check this out. You recognize that lady right here? It's Lady Gaga. How many person can say that I sat down and showed Lady Gaga how to code or did some pair programming? So thank you, Rafi, for being here. Outstanding. The other person is this guy right here. So it's Dr. Mayer. He likes to be called Eric. He pretty much has his hand on every part of Microsoft, right? SQL Server, Volta, OX. I just listed a few. From his Wikipedia webpage, so he has, yes, he does have a Wikipedia page. It lists 150 patents, but I was chatting with him and telling him, I'm trying to match those, and apparently it's 300, so anyhow. So that's Eric. And then finally is Charles, and Last but not least, the thing about Charles is, first, he's a Berkeley product, so Armando, he's one of yours. And what's interesting is that he is doing, for his young age, just a series of small startups that are just very interesting, including the last one, which is Flipboard. If you have an iPad and want to try reading news, I highly recommend it. So Charles is partly responsible for that and really just creating stunningly beautiful web apps and applications. So thank you for being here. So without any more words from me, let's get started. I'll give everybody about 5 minutes to sort of, you know, do your own spiel, whatever you want to say. So how do we start?
Why don't we start with...
With Charles?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. I think you can use this.
Okay. All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Charles from Flipboard. And if you don't know, Flipboard is a your personal social magazine. And that's a very fancy way of saying, what if the web disappeared and we had to rethink it and rebuild it again from scratch? And that's what we think Flipboard is.
It's evangelizing.
It's really a great app.
And so, but more pragmatic level, we are able to take your Facebook account or your Twitter account and turn into a beautifully laid out magazine full of great, rich content. And Flipboard is only available on the iPad today. And the reason for that is that it's a native application. But we don't really think of it as that. We really think of it as a web app, because almost all of Flipboard uses HTTP. A large proportion of the Flipboard client uses HTML5 to lay out all of the magazines. We have 26 magazine publishing partners that work with Flipboard, and they put their magazine content from their websites through our technology, and we lay it out and paginate it to beautifully rendered magazine pages. And all that is done client-side in JavaScript in HTML5. And so we've done a lot of work both on the native side and on the web front as we currently know it. And so we have a lot of opinions about what works and what doesn't in terms of mobile client-side applications. And we believe that whatever you're doing, you want to optimize for the user experience. And we use native iOS, really core Objective-C frameworks. We use C to do Flipboard. And we use JavaScript and HTML5 where it needs to be done, where typography, all that stuff has been solved for us. And so we use each to their own strengths. And so, I mean, for us, from my standpoint, looking at the future, we look at the browser as sort of one platform in relation to the native frameworks, like iOS and Android. Each of them has very similar stacks. You have a view system, which is equivalent to an HTML DOM. You have a language runtime, JavaScript on the browser side, and Objective-C on the native side, or on Android, it's Dalvik. And then you have very similar graphic stacks underneath. We think that the browsers of today, I think what's really wrong with browsers today is that they're not designed or specifically optimized for building those application experiences that you see on a mobile device. And we can hide a lot of it on the desktop, where there's a lot of processing power. This machine has gigaflops of processing power available to it, but which can hide all those abstractions. But on an iPad or an iPhone or an Android device, you really need it to be, you need to really think about your abstractions, think about things like touch responsiveness, animation speed. All those things matter. Abstractions matter on a mobile device. So for us, what needs to be better thought out is how to think about optimizing the entire stack, not just the web apps framework on top, like jQuery Mobile or Sencha or any of the other frameworks. you want to think about the entire stack. Things like the HTML DOM is very well suited for building documents, but not very well suited for building apps, whereas UIKit and the Android frameworks are very good for that. So there it is.
OK, so next person, Rafi. I'll be better at the clock now.
Sorry. How's it going? My name is Rafi Krikorian. So like I said, I run a team that's now called Application Services within Twitter. So we're one of the core infrastructure teams at Twitter. We build all the machinery and framework in order to make Twitter go as fast as it possibly can. Twitter is a real-time network. So speed is the name of our game. So I come from the mobile development world and the application development world from a slightly different perspective. My team is specifically focused on building the infrastructure needed to power all the devices and power all the frameworks that the rest of our product teams goes and builds and deploys onto the world. So for example, the beginning of Twitter's life, we were doing most of our rendering on the server side. So we were running two separate code paths, one of them to power the ecosystem, which today is something like 900,000 applications. And on the other side, we'd be running our own, what we call old Twitter stack. So actually doing all HTML rendering on the server side, all the fragment caching we need to do to push it out as quickly as possible. Recently this year, we deployed something that we call New Twitter, or Phoenix, is what internally we call it. And Phoenix is a pure client-side application. Phoenix is one big JavaScript dump that we do onto the browser. We do a lot of caching, aggressive caching, on the browser and talk to the API purely as an API client, just like the rest of the ecosystem would do. And we have some advantages and some disadvantages there. And my team has been investigating how to get our performance gains that we've done on the server pushed all the way to client-side applications. So for example, like the platform does something around 14 billion requests a day, which comes out to a couple hundred thousand requests per second is what we need to deliver out. And our mean response time is less than 100 milliseconds on any one of those requests. But so it doesn't necessarily matter how fast I scale out my machinery in the world that I'm living in right now. It matters how fast we can render it and display content to the user. So one of our key metrics we monitor is not necessarily response time anymore, but time to first tweet and time to perceived first tweet on all our clients. So we watch this on Phoenix, we watch this on our mobile clients, we watch this on not just mobile web, but like Twitter for Android, iPhone, et cetera. So we're trying to build our stacks in such a way that we can minimize the amount of code we need to rewrite, but still make use of purely native integrations and make sure it all goes really fast. So if you look at all our applications today, they all look about the same, but they all take advantage of slightly different UI implementations. And for example, one of the things that most mobile web applications can't do and that we rely on heavily is mobile notifications. So we can't just simply do our M5, our new HTML5 iPhone and smartphone experiences, because we want to be able to push content to people. So Twitter is all about reaching out and touching people in some way, and that's something that we just can't do in just pure web applications these days. So, in short, I'm interested in making sure performance scales not just from the server side, but think about performance all the way to perceived load time for users and making use of purely mobile native applications similar to the iOS integration that we've been working on recently to extend it all the way through and make it pervasive.
Okay, so thank you. So next person is Patrick.
Hi, everybody. My name is Patrick Chenezon. And I work for Google in developer relations. Over the past 6 years, I've been taking care of very different APIs. And like Michael said, I like to tinker with different things. So my specialty is to create new teams when there's a new technology coming. And related to this panel, the main idea I wanted to convey is that I really have the impression, having been doing software for 20 years, that I'm like a hamster in a training wheel. And I'd like to explain that the wheel is turning right now and that we're living a big transition.
But you're not progressing.
Actually, we're progressing. I think the wheel is just getting bigger. So the potential of the apps that we're building is wider, and we're touching more people. So the wheel I wanted to describe is when I started working 20 years ago, I started building client-server applications. So you built all the logic on the client side, a little bit on the server side with a relational database, which scaled a little bit, vertical scalability at that time. Very quickly, when I moved to Netscape, we had the web model. And the web model was really a comeback to the 60s, to a mainframe type of programming, because when you were building web apps at that time, essentially you were building all the logic on the server side, and your client was just like a glorified VT100 client with fancy fonts and images, but not much power on the client side. So there was this language called JavaScript where you could make your app a little bit more interesting, but there was not much power there. So this evolved until around like beginning of 2000, when companies like Google started like leveraging XML HTTP requests, which was invented at Microsoft, and web apps started to have more state, become more interesting, look more like native apps. And this transition went up to today, where I think we're seeing a switch back to client server. So today we essentially have a very powerful web client with HTML5 that have all the same characteristics as your rich client environment, OS2 or Windows, had in the 90s. So you have like 2D graphic capabilities, 3D audio, video, processes and local storage, which is pretty important. And then on the other side, you have all these mobile platforms, whether iPhone or Android, which lets you build these apps that you can like take away with you. And they have local storage and lots of capabilities as well. And what I'm experiencing is that right now, we're at a transition where we're going a little bit out of the web model, back to a client-server model where people want to work with their apps anywhere in a disconnected mode. And I think the key will be in syncing, and architectures like Lotus Notes from 20 years ago. One of the things that made me smile 5 years ago when Ray Ozzie joined Microsoft, his brother Jack created a spec for syncing over RSS. It never went anywhere, and I think they didn't do much with it. But I found it very interesting because I think he had noticed that we're going back to this model where synchronization will be very important. And to me, the validating point of that, the fact that we're going back to that architecture, is the keynote of Steve Jobs last week at the WDCC. He presented iCloud, which is essentially a synchronization architecture where all the Apple apps are going to be synchronized with the cloud. So I think that's the kind of context of big architecture change that happens every 15 years that we're living today thanks to the transition of mobile HTML5 and the cloud on the server side.
Thank you, Patrick. Okay, so last but not least,
well,
is
Eric.
Well,
I think Patrick more eloquently said what I wanted to say as well. I have to make a confession. So there was an article recently about what's going on with Rails. Well, I have to confess, I never understood Rails. I was always too stupid, and I expect that most people really didn't understand Rails either, and they pretended that they knew it. I think this, you know, having these web apps was always a bad idea. You know, it's kind of crazy to generate, you know, your UI on the server side, project it to the client. That's not how things work. So I'm really happy that we're going back to the client-server architecture. And also then on the server side, we can go back to CGI scripts. I mean, why do you need anything more complicated than CGI scripts on the back end? So when it comes to technology, I'm really kind of conservative, and I like to have simple things. And I think abstract a little bit what the first two speakers said, if you're going to a more world where there's kind of many different devices, you're kind of forced into that architecture where, you know, you cannot, you know, if you have a mobile phone that's native, you cannot send HTML to it. So you're kind of forced to make your server side really kind of pure, like an RPC model, basically. And then, you know, you're doing all your UI and other work on the client side. And I also agree with Patrick that this notion of synchronization is super important because people want to use their devices, you know, wherever, and they want to, you know, have this nebulous thing where your data is always there. That said, I think the idea of synchronization is not, it works, you know, for like for email, Outlook or something, it works, but I'm not so sure that it will work for any form of data. Like with on my with iTunes, I'm always afraid when I sync the thing that like half of my songs suddenly disappear. And so this is, I think, the biggest challenge that we have is to make synchronization work, you know, that my mother-in-law can deal with it. And that's a very high bar.
Is that it? Okay, thank you. All right. Where do I start? We have a lot of fights between Microsoft and Google here. Actually, to the point of synchronization, there's actually a good example is that I move all my devices to iOS 5, and I lost all my contacts on my iPhone. So there is a problem there. So we'll take on this, which is, so you think that having the cloud integrated with your client-server application, whether it be a web-based application or it be a device application, is sort of the strategy. But of course, synchronization entails how do you resolve conflicts, how do you deal with the fact that I lost my data, and maybe I had some special contacts in there that I lost. So that's gonna be huge. Isn't this a step backward, though? Isn't this a huge step backward? Because right now I used to be able to sync without any issues and deal with the different conflicts. So I think, I mean, this is interesting, but it's a step backward, right? Isn't it? You guys didn't agree or didn't mention, this new architecture world. Apple likes it. What do you think?
Well, Flipboard is not completely Apple aligned, but I'll say that the biggest problem with sync is actually not with technology. It's with the mental model, the user model. A user has to be able to understand what's going on with their data. And for us to magically say that it will be available to you everywhere works up until a point where you get a problem, like a conflict. And that's where things have to be understood by the user. And one of the things, if you notice with Apple's models, that they can constantly talk about push and pull sharing in their model. So I think that's their direction for how they're going to address sync, which is users think about sharing, just like with iTunes music, you're sharing it actively with the particular devices you want it on. Or you pick up your iPhone and you don't get all your apps instantly on there, you have to go and download them again. That's the model that users understand. Okay. And I think that's where things start, if you can start there.
So there is a user gap. I was at WWDC, but I can't talk about too much, as you know. So thank you for that. Graphy, you want to add anything?
I mean, so sync is clearly one of the problems that Twitter has right now. Like one of the, like right now I have at least 4 devices which are connected to my Twitter account, and my DM unread red state is inconsistent across all of them. And it's one of our biggest complaints from users, and they just want to have seamless access to information in a way that's consistent for them, and that like things that you understand what's new, especially in the world of Twitter where it's all about what's going on now. I don't care about what happened before. So I mean, I agree it's a user perception issue in some way. Like it fundamentally doesn't matter what goes on behind the scenes, it matters what the user actually sees.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I take question from the audience. So please, raise your hand.
I'm Armando Fox from Cal, and thank you guys so much for coming. This is great. A couple of things that I haven't heard anyone mention yet, I think, even though they seem to be pretty important newish features of mobile applications, whether or not they interact with the web. One of them is a lot of the interesting client-side apps are multi-server. So, a mashup is sort of the canonical old school example, but even Flipboard, right? It's a native app, but a lot of its power comes from the fact that it's aggregating things from what otherwise would be separate services. And the other aspect that I haven't heard people mention is the social networking. Today, it's hard to imagine someone would release an app that does not include social networking features, right? Like, you don't log in anymore. You connect with your Facebook account or your Google account, and you know, there's the idea of an app where your friends cannot somehow participate in your usage of the app seems outdated. So, is there kind of anything new under the sun or anything missing in the development ecosystem to support those things? Because they seem to be pretty high profile things.
Well, talking specifically about Flipboard, Flipboard is not just a client-side application, although I sort of skipped over the server-side piece. Flipboard is actually a very extensive and deep server-side infrastructure as well as the client-side. And so when you actually add your social networking accounts, we actually spend a lot of time processing things on the server because we could never give you that experience if we were just a client-side application.
Okay, so you don't divide the work. In some sense, you don't want to be... It's not that you built it server-side because there was some logistical obstacle to doing it on the client. You have to do some things at the server-side in order to give the experience.
That's right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's pretty important.
I mean, from our standpoint, like, Twitter has a service-oriented architecture, right? So we have many hundreds of different services in the back end which all get touched upon tweet write or tweet read. And so we do a lot of work to make sure we present a single unified API to a whole bunch of different infrastructure. We don't actually allow one potential solution would be to allow the phone to talk directly to all the different services and do a composition layer on the phone itself. The reason we don't do that, though, is like that's crazy battery expensive. Like, we much rather have our composition layer be hosted on the server itself, so you do one API request, and then we'll figure out what to do from there. And in fact, this pervades in many different ways. Like, I work very hard to make sure we have a clean and open API that anyone could use. That's not exactly the same API we use ourselves. So, like, we do a lot of different shortcuts to batch APIs together to push them on one connection over to our device itself, because every single request I make is going to eat my battery by a fraction of a percent.
Yeah. So not to short circuit Patrick, from whom I want to hear, but Eric, given what Rafi just said, do you still really want to go back to just CGI and no server-side programming frameworks? I mean, I'm guessing you guys don't write every composition layer from scratch, right? You probably have your own non-trivial internal frameworks that make it easier to do new batches and new compositions of services and stuff like that. So isn't this a necessary evil?
Yes, but I think, so one of the things I think is that we, and you see this now, there's a backlash where people are backlash. If you look at things like Node.js, where people go back to simplicity, I think, you know, we went overboard with frameworks, dependency injection, WCF, whatever, you know, attributes, declarative, and you have no clue what's going on anymore. And so I like to see codes, you know, where I can put a debugger and I can see what's going on. So I like composition, but I don't like my composition to be hidden away in layers and layers and layers of noise that doesn't really kind of, you know, help me to understand my real problem. Another thing that I would like to say is when you say people log in with, you know, say Facebook, OAuth, already the name is kind of, you know, bad because I cannot pronounce it and maybe many other people. But also as a developer, it's incredibly hard to use and it has to pop up a web page, which is kind of, you know, strange because we're all talking about like diverse devices. And now in order to kind of log in, I have to kind of somehow put a web page, you know, in some other UI. So I think we have a long ways to go there to make things simpler. The other danger I see is all the apps now, you know, they use Facebook to log in, but I have no clue anymore what these apps do because it's too automatic. You know, now you might as well just throw away all this authentication because the user doesn't have a perception anymore that something, you know, dangerous is happening. So I think they're in that respect, making things transparently social is, I think, a little bit dangerous.
So, add anything?
I strongly believe a composition layer is equivalent to a compiler in some ways. So, like, it's all about tooling and the way to understand what the composition layer is actually doing at that given time. Like, so, abstraction layers are great to explain how things work, but when a compiler does, it slams them all together again. So, I think that's true. However, I will agree that OAuth in the browser is fundamentally broken, which is very much why we've pushed really hard to have a native authentication mechanism on iOS 5. the one main reasons to do OAuth in the browser is to see what the URL is, but users just fundamentally do not understand how that actually works.
Patrick?
Yeah, I just wanted to rebound on the original question, because these were part of the themes I wanted to talk about, which I think one of the very important themes that emerged over the past 6 years is the componentization of the web, which is when you're going to a web page, if you were going 10 years ago to a web page, you would have like maybe 80% of the content coming from that website and maybe 20% ads and stuff like that. Now it's more like 80% content coming from either Google or Facebook or Twitter through gadgets or JavaScript APIs, and then 20% coming directly from your website. So this was due to the rise of JavaScript APIs, and at Google we have a bunch of these, and what we're trying to do is to make it easier for people to create APIs. So in our cloud offering, we have App Engine and a whole bunch of Google Data APIs that allows you to consume our products, but through software on the server side or on the client side through JavaScript APIs. So I think that rise of JavaScript APIs is a big trend. And when you're building your app today, I think you should do like Twitter. You just build the API first. And then they didn't start this way, but this should be the way you start a new project. You build the API first, expose it in some way of a REST API, and then consume it on the various clients that you're building for it.
Yeah, this is interesting, but of course, you know, I love Twitter, nothing wrong with it, but it's a pretty simple client interface, right? If you start getting into a more complicated, I'm sure in the back end it's very complicated, but, right? So maybe not. If you have questions, okay, John. Because otherwise, I want to switch to
a new topic. Let's see.
Actually, I wanted to switch to a new topic.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, I'm John Osterhoff from Stanford. Thanks, guys, for being here. I want to ask about client apps, because I don't get it. So it seems like the trend of the last 20 years is that we don't do applications that are shrink wrap install binaries. We do web applications, and everything that can be delivered by the web is moving to the web, at least in the workstation world. And then along come these mobile devices, iPhones and whatnot, and all of a sudden Steve Jobs stands up and proclaims that no, applications are the right way to do things, and everybody salivates and drools, and like the Pavlovian dog at the ring of the bell, and goes off and starts building mobile apps, and so native apps for these devices. So I don't get it. It seems to me all of the problems that motivated the move to the web for workstations will afflict these mobile applications, proliferation of platforms and different APIs and hassles of porting, all that kind of stuff. So why isn't this just a temporary blip, sort of an accident, and people are going to wake up and realize this, and that 10 years from now, aren't essentially all of the applications on mobile devices going to be web applications?
Thank you, John.
Okay, this is a very sticky issue. Hold on. Let's see. Okay, who wants to take this?
Oh, go first. Go ahead.
So I think the situation is not as radical as you suggest, because the way, if you think about it slightly more abstractly, a native app, say on the iPhone, is actually a web app, because you go to an app store and you kind of download it, and then from there on it gets updated and so on. So it's not something that, you know, it's kind of hardwired in your, you can see that when you go to the App Store, it's like, you know, you're visiting a website where your HTML page is loaded. The only thing is that it stays on your device.
But the fact that I have to go to a store and buy it means it's already not a web app.
Well, Google has their own. There are web app stores, right? So Google has one, Firefox has one. So the notion of a market, that's okay. No.
We kind of made a lot of progress with that. So I think what John is saying is, why are we screwing around with that and saying, oh, no, depending on which company's device you have, or maybe even which model of device, there's N different app stores, right? And if you download an app on, you know, your phone today and you buy an Android phone tomorrow, you have to go re-download the app, and maybe it won't be quite the same. So,
well, because somebody has to make money, right? So by going to a web store, I don't know.
So is that a good answer? So do you guys disagree?
To answer your question about web apps, almost all the native apps I've seen on these devices are all HTTP-based in some way. Flipboard is that way. Flipboard is HTTPS-based. And so we consider ourselves fundamentally of the web. But it's one more of necessity. Getting that kind of user experience on the mobile device requires breaking away a lot of those abstractions. We can't achieve all of the nuances of our UI with a web app.
Then should we just fix HTML5?
Isn't that just a glitch, but right? A temporary, so, the touch stuff isn't exported properly, just a few minor things like that, and the problem goes away?
Well, if you look at the completeness of time, of course. If you step back far away enough, of course it's a blip in time. We basically are going through this big wheel, as Patrick says, of reinventing technology. It's sort of like a pendulum of going between client, server, and web. As the maturity of each technology base gets better, we'll gravitate towards whatever is better. Right now, doing native apps is better. It's better from an economic standpoint. It's better from a technology standpoint. It's better right now. But it's a necessity. You can't just build this pure paradigm or paragon of architecture and have it work. We think HTML5 is the best thing ever, but you know, it in practice on mobile devices.
But there's a point that Rafi made, which was the fact that a lot of the reason their new application moves a lot to the client and they have to worry is because those client devices are constrained, right? Memory, CPU, battery, and you have to worry about this. And if you look at what Apple does, and as an iOS and even Android developer, you can see that there's a lot of communication between the platform and the apps so that they don't spend too much time draining the battery. So there's that issue. And those constraints are going to be there, right? You can't assume that the mobile device is going to have a lot of power. So
I wanted to answer your question because I think it's the mother of all questions for this panel,
yes,
and this debate. What about the App Store? Why this question of native versus HTML, and why do I need to buy my app in an App Store? And I think the answer is that in the past few years, we've seen like platforms taking over or providing all these orthogonal services. So one of them is geo. Now you can geolocate your users, you can put maps, and you can play with geography. The second one was social, and that was like 4 years ago, Facebook and now Twitter. Now you can have the identity of the user have access to their social graph. But one aspect that was missing was distribution and monetization. And what you're seeing this year is basically a whole set of new ways to monetize your applications. And I think we're really at the innovation phase right now, where it's completely chaotic. You need to build your app, you need to put it on the like iTunes Store, and then you need to build one for Android. At Google, we have the Chrome Web Store, where you can monetize your web app. We also have the Google Apps Marketplace, where you can monetize your web apps targeted towards enterprise. Recently, VMware started something called Horizon, where same thing, they synchronize identity for, it's more for enterprise use. So you see all these app stores appearing. I think Amazon has one now for Android as well. And what these app stores bring you is distribution and monetization. Now, what will distribution and monetization look like in 5 years? I have no clue. I think we're really in the innovation phase, where lots of players are trying to provide ways to monetize and deploy your applications. And then there will be lots of innovation, consolidation, maybe some open source projects in this area, I'm not sure. But I think we're not in a blip in time. We're in this innovation phase where there's lots of creativity and lots of different offerings. And frankly, I have no clue what will
So we're at a Cambrian phase, and things will sort of settle down, and Apple is not going to rise as the only winner.
I certainly hope so.
Let's see if you had a comment.
My only comment was, you asked a question, what did we... Why do we keep going back? Well, I would also say, what's the memory span of the average age of the individuals who start a lot of these companies? They may not remember the history. They may not actually remember where a lot of that came from. And it is about monetization. I mean, you brought up the point. It's going back. Well, it's like, I mean, how many times has this happened in the technology cycle? I mean, I've always, honestly, on a technology perspective, I've always sat there and gone, great, you could have done this six other ways more efficiently, but somebody could have gotten the dollars for it, which is, it's greed.
And you are?
Lane Inman.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so I think John pointed to something I wanted to raise, which is HTML5, right? It's the big elephant in the room. Is it the solution to a lot of these problems? Because everybody seems to be agreeing with it, but nobody is really pushing it as the only way for their devices or for their approaches. Microsoft's talking about Windows 8. They're going to support it, but they're still .NET. Google, Android has its native platform. Apple has its own, right? Twitter has multiple versions. So is HTML5 the holy grail?
So I think we have always tried to come up with this kind of universal GUI thing, and I don't think it has ever worked. And HTML5, in some sense, is another attempt to have like a universal GUI framework that, you know, is like write once, run everywhere. And I think with HTML5, people do, or in HTML, it's like you don't even need HTML5. People do kind of, you know, remarkable things where they can skin, you know, by doing clever use of CSS, they can make things look kind of like native apps. But I think it's, people know that, you know, if it's not really native, it's you still so see the kind of rough edges. And And so,
the experience is not the same.
Exactly. And so I don't think that HTML5 will be the kind of, you know, there's no silver bullet if we kind of, you know,
okay,
learn from
so
history.
That's a good one. 0 to 1 now. Let's see what you say.
Okay, so as an individual, I'm kind of biased. I used to be at Netscape, and I remember all the dreams we had that are kind of realizing themselves now, like the ability to create applications in HTML and JavaScript that are as good as native ones. So I'm very strongly biased towards that. Now, at the same time, I agree that you cannot do everything with it, and right now there are lots of limitations, especially when you're talking about mobile. What I think is really interesting is the fact that people are trying to create ways to monetize your HTML5 applications. To me, the Chrome Web Store is kind of a good indication of how that could look like. But again, I'm not sure what it will look like in 5 years from now. So is it the silver bullet? I agree with Eric. I don't think there's any silver bullet in our job line. We're really like still in a very strong innovation phase.
So it's just an additional framework in the toolbox.
Yeah, you, but an important one.
Yes.
Why is it important? Because, you know, a lot of people tell me, okay, HTML5. Like I look at the New York Times HTML5. If you haven't tried it, and you can flip, and you can touch. Guess what? I could do that 3 years ago, right, with my iOS device. So all of a sudden, I have this new framework that can do all of this, and it's slowly catching up. I can't do geotagging. Well, yeah, it's going to come up next week. I can't really check my battery. Yeah, maybe next month. So again, I agree with to some extent with what Eric was saying, is that it's there, but it's not quite there.
So I think it's all about like how wide you want your app to be deployed. If you're doing iOS only, sure, just do everything native. But then if you want to have also an Android version and a version that works on the web, then HTML5, you can build as much as the app as you can in HTML5.
So build a sucky version in HTML5, but it works everywhere.
Not necessarily the sucky version. I'm using the Gmail client on iPhone and iPad. I'm using mostly the HTML5 version. I don't use the native app on
these. We should talk afterwards.
So you're thinking it's catching up. Any point about HTML5? Because this is a half vote from Patrick. It's sort of not really in one corner or the other.
Well, having done a lot of HTML5 work in the past with hardware acceleration and that kind of stuff, there's a lot you can do. HTML5 is successful because it's the new moniker for the modern web browser and the modern web platform. But it's still got a ways to go. I mean, we try to build great experiences with it, but we find that the frame rates just aren't cutting it when we want to do some kind of new animation. And a lot of people will say, it's good enough, but we look at it and hold it to a higher standard where we say 60 frames a second is good enough. That's where people really don't notice the difference between the two. But at 30, at 20, at 15, you see all these demos at various conferences about, well, look at this cool thing I can do in HTML or Flash or something else, and the frame rate is just 6 frames a second.
So give it some time, it will catch up.
It will catch up. It's also extremely hard to do these things. So as the hardware gets faster, as frameworks get better and make this easier to do, because right now you need to have a very deep background and understanding of the entire platform in order to get that kind of performance out of HTML5. If you give it time to mature, it will get there. But there's a lot of impedance towards making it work today.
Okay. I'll count that as a half vote. You can break the tie now.
No,
it's 1-1.
I'm just going to go with HTML5 is really nice to look at, but it doesn't, like, for my type of applications, it doesn't expand the entire breadth of the platform I need, right? So like, it doesn't allow me to run things in the background. It gives me some really pretty things to do, but I can't send notifications to users. I can't monitor things on behalf of the user. A mobile app to me is more than just a UI. And so like for the UI purpose of it, sure, whatever. It might be a little slow, provides a really nice abstraction layer, changes the quality, not quality, the type of developer that we can hire Twitter in order to do programming for us. But it's only half of the application for me, and it does that half fine.
So is it more like the content? You look at it as it's the content, and then it lives within a framework for the device or for...
Yeah, that's a fair way to say it.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Did you have a...
Yeah, one last remark. One thing I found really interesting at Google I.O. this year is that the show was dominated by the two teams, Chrome and Android. There was one day for Chrome, one day for Android. Each of them were pushing the vision of, like, on the Android side, it should be all native on Android, and we have this new platform and these new gizmos and all that. And then the next day, you had the Chrome guys, like, showing demos running at 60 frames per second with 3D accelerated WebGL.
On the desktop.
On the desktop, yeah, I agree. And trying to push that vision, and they're pushing even laptops, like Chromebooks that are running just Chrome, and that's the new OS. I think the jury's still out on which vision will win, and frankly, I don't know.
So even at Google, the house is divided. I hope it stands, though. Yeah. Go ahead.
Ben Lerner, University of Washington. So I want to some sort of counterpoint to what Eric suggested, that this is, it never quite feels native, right? The other way to look at it is that it is its own platform. Right. If you have the same Twitter app, let's say on iOS and Android and WinPhone 7 and WebOS and pick your platform, they're never going to look identical, right? But you have the potential, at least with HTML and CSS, to make it look identical, right? So rather than holding it up to this sort of absurd standard that it never feels native, it's its own native feel. Right now, you actually have the chance to make good on the original promise of Java that was write once, run anywhere, and it looks the same. Damn it, you know, it's going to feel the same no matter what you do. So that's sort of one possibility with HTML. Now to come back to your point that the UI is only half the story, right? By the same token, as you've all been saying, this is a very innovative time. And whether iOS or WinPhone 7 or Android has gotten the story completely right, they clearly haven't, because different apps run better on different platforms. So in some sense, it's sort of an opportunity to pick and innovate from all of these things. So I think potentially one of the really cool points, and I wonder what you guys are sort of thinking in this space, is whether there seems to be consensus building under the HTML Next umbrella, whether that you call it 5 or JavaScript Next or whatever, to actually combine the best of the ideas from these platforms and then stop bickering over who gets the shiniest back buttons in their frameworks.
So he's firmly in the camp of HTML5. The question, I guess if I can make up a question, is that it's the solution, just deal with it. But how do you differentiate, right?
How would Flipboard differentiate from the next person like you that creates something like this?
Yeah, this is like, your argument is like, we should all drive a Trabant. Is they're all the same.
Mobile devices are highly personal. HTML5 is well suited for this write once, run everywhere on the desktop, but mobile devices are just a new category of computing. We used to call this, back in the 90s, ubiquitous computing. And we just don't know what that looks like. And to compound on top of that, it's a highly profitable and competitive area of the market. So you're going to be seeing a lot of misinformation and stuff about that. So it's a new thing. And whatever this HTML mobile, next mobile thing will look like, we're not sure. And I think it'll be interesting to see if it actually can be solved by creating this common platform. Whereas, I mean, you look at Android and iOS, they both have very different user experiences that are tailor-suited for each type of user.
Yeah, so from that standpoint, I actually would contend that, like, for Twitter, we don't want our apps to look the same across all different platforms. Like, ubiquitous computing is one word for it, but, like, it's kind of like intimate computing, right? Like, this is the one device that's basically on my body almost 24 hours a day in some way, shape, or form. Like, it's my alarm clock that's next to the bed, is in my back pocket during the day. And, like, I won't use an Android phone. I think it looks ugly, whatever. But people who do use Android phones won't use iPhones. So, like, there are aspects of the different phones and different capabilities that you actually want to tailor to the type of user that wants to use it. And so trying to get all the vendors to agree on everything to make it all look exactly the same probably is actually going in the wrong direction.
No. Hold on a second. So there is a good thing, though, and you're next. Is that with HTML5, one of the good things, not for mobile, is that whether I'm using a Mac, Linux, or Windows, and I use IE, Chrome, or Firefox, my application will be the same. So that's actually a big win, isn't it? For HTML5, right? For web apps.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Sure.
So that there's a good thing for HTML5. It's just not for mobile, I guess. That's maybe the message here. Hold on.
Let me go.
No, you go.
I'll go.
You talk maybe a lot. Dylan.
Dylan Stummett from ELC Technologies. I think everybody wants the phone and all their components to do all the same things. They want to pick up and, as you were saying, have your Twitter updated to your last thing that you've read. You want the data available on all the devices. You want the same user experience in some cases. I think the one thing that, you know, why HTML5, for instance, is you know, catching up in WebSockets is still kind of immature in ways. Is that big companies have lots of money to put towards, you know, there's lots of money in the game in terms of having their own hardware and having their own native applications. So, from a developer standpoint, when you want to enable all the devices to share push across, Google Cloud or APNS. It just gets harder and harder and harder. Start using web frameworks with web sockets. So from a developer standpoint, do you guys see HTML, W3C catching up to the big names out there in the native space? Or do you expect the developer ecosystem to get more difficult to keep up when you want to develop for everything?
So development on a native platform is easier, HTML5 a little bit harder.
You have to use more, you have to, you know, developing something for a client you want to do, they want an Android app, they want an iPhone app, they want a native app, and they want real-time push and all of it, and it's like, oh, Jesus, you have to use 30 different technologies.
Build three different applications.
Yeah, is it going to be 60 in the future, or is it going to be less?
Anybody?
I can give my dark view on this. So we all know, and when I used to be an academic, I was teaching, you have to separate the UI layer from the business logic, blah, blah, blah. In practice, when you write code, that never happens. Okay, so these things kind of all blend together. And so I think it's really hard to kind of, even when you want to say I'm writing, this code and I factor it carefully such that I can reuse it against different devices. So you might as well embrace the fact that you just, you write for this thing, for that thing, and then you get the best experience for each device. I think that's just, all these other things are too hard. You have to,
As you get older, you know, all your dreams go out of the window, and I think just hacking is the right way to go.
I'm still a dreamer.
You're young at heart.
Should we switch shirts?
Yeah, exactly. Your shirt is much more apt to that. But to me, the standards, like HTML5, I don't think innovation should be done in standards. Standards are there to just standardize best practices at a certain moment in the evolution of the technology, so that everybody can work on the same substrate that everybody agrees on. Now, at a certain point in time, if you look at the standard and you look at how people are innovating, the innovators are always a few steps ahead. And I think that's what we're seeing in the mobile space now, where on the native side, they are pushing like super optimized things that really are frameworks that work really best on small form factors. While HTML5, what it has done is it has standardized the kind of stuff that you wanted to do in HTML applications when you want to do 2D, 3D video and all that. Now, if you're like Charles or Rafi and are building, you have a whole team building a super unique experience, like changing the way you're using your phone or you're interacting with your friends, you want to go native because you want all the capabilities of the device. Now, if you're building an enterprise web app for reporting or something like that, maybe you don't maybe you don't care about that. Maybe all you want is the app to be coded real quickly and to run on all your devices, and then you should use HTML5.
Or DOS.
I think HTML5 is a new DOS.
So Eric, feel free to be positive once in a while.
And actually, one thing I that struck me at Google I/O this year is that the Android team was pushing a lot of consumer-oriented themes like home automation or peripherals, while the Chrome team seemed really focused on the enterprise. Like the Chromebook are an enterprise offering, so they were pushing in this area. So what I think will happen in the next year is that we'll see a big wave of enterprise adoption of HTML5, while companies in the consumer space who need the optimized user experience will continue crafting their apps on various devices to have a very personal experience on them.
So if you're a consumer, you're hot, you're interesting, you're doing innovative stuff, you're enterprise, you're boring, you're fat. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment.
Can you introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah, Brian from Mitosciences in Eugene. I just wanted to comment on the idea of custom native apps. As from the perspective of a developer, I think the job aspect of that is a great one, such that if there is a general solution for everything, you need to make something once and it covers all platforms. However, if you have a custom creation for each thing, it means larger developing teams and more jobs. So
yeah.
Okay.
Well, hold on. There is somebody in the back. No. Come on. Yes. Oh, Mendo can wait.
Charles, earlier you mentioned a term, modern browser, and this term has kind of been around for a long time in the IE versus Netscape. We kind of had this idea of, well, if we don't really all need to agree on something, because eventually when we get to this modern point, everything will all work. And we kind of still have this paradigm today where everyone's just kind of waiting for browsers to catch up. And we've heard the phrase catch up a lot. And one thing I find telling is what we haven't heard is the idea of accessibility. And so we have kind of two differing viewpoints, and I'm really speaking only from the perspective of web apps and ignoring the fact that, well, making native applications is really the answer here. But we have the idea of graceful degradation, where you want to code so that if a browser is older or really any kind of the platform that you're running it on can't run everything, well, it's okay to, we don't want to code for specific instances or do any sort of sniffing to find out, you know, what it is and then serve that version of the code. And then you have a completely opposite viewpoint where it's like, well, we want to write IE-specific style sheets, that was really big a few years ago, or even browser-specific scripts. And I was wondering what your guys' kind of thoughts are on accessibility in that space in terms of degradation versus specific coding for different clients.
Thank you, Jim. From
Corisoft. Okay. Who wants to take this? Charles?
In terms of accessibility and graceful degradation, for many years, I used to work on the OpenWave mobile browser back in a previous life for cell phones that were modern phones at the time with a half a meg of heap. So some perspective there. I would say that graceful degradation has always been, for consumer apps, has always been a myth. We try our best to use what's available when these standards bodies have created these wonderful things that will gracefully degrade over time. But in practice, for really innovative consumer apps, it doesn't really work, and you have to create your own things. That being said, accessibility is an important feature to have in an application, and we do build it in, but we treat it as a platform or a feature of the application. And many native toolkits do this very well, as does the standards, like HTML has a very big accessibility component. So those things are there and used when needed. But to the point of degradation, separating that from accessibility, degradation has never really worked in my experience for the really truly innovative consumer experiences.
And talking about accessibility and HTML5, there's lots of work done on something called Y. And TV Raman from Google is working a lot in this area. The big progress there's been in the past few years on accessibility for web apps is making JavaScript-intensive apps more accessible. I remember when I was talking with TV a few years ago, he really wanted like REST APIs for all Google products because he was consuming the products in Emacs, not in the browser. Right now, he's trying to push for people to start using Y and define some roles for their JavaScript and DOM nodes so that you can plug a screen reader into it to get it to work. Now, I don't know if all that stuff works well on mobile.
So isn't Flipboard all about accessibility? Because, you know, web pages look ugly and you're kind of trying to make them, you know, accessible to normal people with some nice aesthetics?
We try to, however, Flipboard is very custom, and so we don't always implement all of the iOS accessibility extensions. We do try to do it when we can.
Okay. So if I could switch gears for a minute, iOS, Android, HTML5, the web, like every few, you know, Windows Mobile 7, this time for sure. There's all these different platforms, right? So some of us whose main job is to be educators are also wondering, some of you, this is not your first rodeo, right? What do you see as the kind of foundational concepts, regardless of which way things go or whatever, we want to be able to teach future developers, future computer scientists to architect and do apps like this, regardless of whether the industry decides it's going to be HTML5 or every platform for themselves? So what should we be teaching that kind of elevates us above the until the dust settles?
So
anybody?
Go ahead. I have a take on that. I think in universities, you should teach future developers, like really hardcore computer science, and in terms of languages, I would say one language of each type, like imperative, functional, logic, so that they have access to all the types, maybe do some projects in this area, and then teach them how to read a doc, how to write code, data structure and algorithms. I would focus on the basics because the specifics of the technology at a certain point will change when they'll be on the market, and what they need to learn is to learn how to learn. I think it's much more important than any specifics.
But it also needs to sink in by building something real, right?
So how, you know, what do you do to build something real?
So to build something real,
engineering, basically.
Yeah, so I would ask them to build something on whatever they want that they find fashionable at that time, but just focus on the basics of computer science, like data structure, algorithms, and various types of languages.
Yeah. So I think we should teach them category theory, very heavy category theory. And so the reason is, I'm not really joking. The thing is that if you look at category theory, this is really mathematicians taking the idea of interface-based design to the extreme. Okay, they look at a lot of mathematical theories and they say, what is the interface that, you know, this theory implements? And then we throw away the theory and we focus on the interface. And so I think that's a very good skill, because what you see is that a lot of things looked very different, but they're really implementations of a more general interface. And if we can teach students to kind of, you know, look at things and abstract the essence from what's really going on, then you can kind of easily transfer those skills. So for me, I think, you know, universities should teach people or students to really learn how to abstract, kind of distill the thing down to the essence. And once you can do that, you know, it doesn't really matter what the implementation is underneath.
You also need to, on the flip side, also teach them how to break down the abstractions and understand what's really happening underneath. Something like machine structures course is a very humbling experience to have to step through a debugger or disassemble something. And the other thing I would mention is a compiler, strong compiler class. Is something that's very important to understanding how languages work.
Rafi, are you going to add group theory to it?
I mean, for my education, right? So like
graph theory.
Yeah. Undergrads were taught everything in Scheme, right? So we never actually learned a practical language by any means. But I mean, this sort of also pervades to Twitter in some way. Like we use Scala on our backend services, so like no one knows that language when they show up at Twitter. And so the requirement is that you can get up to speed pretty quickly.
Okay. Thank you. I think we have a question here.
Hi. Deepak Jeevan Kumar. Moonlighting now, but formerly from Yale and Sun Microsystems. I think one of the issues that I'm not seeing getting enough attention in the entire mobile apps or web apps or whatever you want to call it is the issue of security. And how do you see, I mean, there's so many challenges that can come. Some can be learned from the web world, and some are probably going to be completely, entirely new. How do you see these issues evolving, and what, from your vantage point, right, what do you see are the main issues in the next couple of years?
Especially since, as you mentioned, these devices are very personal. My whole life is in there, right?
I mean, for us, it's actually something even more than security. So, like, Twitter does this all the time. We do incremental rollouts of features. We turn features on and off for particular people. We want to guard your data in certain ways. So like in these current cases, we actually can't do everything on the client side. Like running client side is running in an untrusted environment for me. So like I need to actually have centralized control over a lot of data and only make sure I'm providing it in very specific ways to certain people. So for that alone, like HTML5 environments also become really interesting. Like for we accidentally for a while had JavaScript out there that we relied on the clients to turn on and off features. So we'd say like activate this feature please, but then we just exposed all the code to the entire world. So right now we actually dole out JavaScript in very careful ways in a very close client server partnership. Can't just go fully client.
You have a positive thought on security?
Security.
Well, I think the world has become recently very scary because it shows that, you know, most of our systems are not very secure, and as the hackers get kind of, you know, more creative and see it's an economic argument also, I think, or, you know, I saw a nice comic where, you know, there was like this kind of nerdy guy and there was the jock and he was saying, you know, if you don't give me your lunch money, I will hack your website or something like that. But we're really entering, I think, a very scary world, and I think when we're trying too fast to kind of build features and so on, where maybe we should say, let's make sure that this thing is like, you know, 100% safe, because in this world, you know, you have to, like, there was this thing from Citibank, you know, like, I think a great hack where they kind of just change some numbers in the URI. Beautiful. I could be a hacker too, but...
Yeah, let's design for security. Okay. Tell this to Sony,
exactly,
right?
But, I mean, but yes, but you have to be kind of, you know, extremely careful, and you know, it worries me that we, because it's hard to read these. Sometimes these leaks are so. It's like, how can we have to have better tools and things to kind of help us with making things secure.
Okay. Any you want?
Yeah, I have two takes on that. So one of them is that yes, centralization of data helps with security. One example I have is at Google, for Google Apps, for example, when you're using Google Apps for your domain, we provide administrators with tools that let them monitor who's accessing the apps when. And these tools can, on top of these APIs, you can build a detection monitoring apps that detect when there's unauthorized access to your data at the corporate level. So that's one example. Another aspect of security that I think is important is when we are moving to this componentized web, when your page is running like 50 scripts that all come from different areas, this causes lots of interesting issues. And we had to deal with that when we created Open Social, which was like a gadget specification for running social gadgets on your pages. The whole idea of Open Social is that you would run untrusted JavaScript from a random developer within your Orkut page or your MySpace page and all that. And so there's been lots of work into security there. I know of two projects that tackled that, securing JavaScript, running random JavaScript on your page. One of them is called Kaha. It's led by Google. It's an open source project where they basically recompile your JavaScript on the server side. And they add capabilities-based security to JavaScript. And the other project is from Microsoft. I forgot the name, but it's the same idea where they're rewriting the JavaScript that runs in your browser. Do you remember the name of that project?
Sandbox. So both of them really are, a way to look at it is they virtualize every language construct in JavaScript, and you can intercept and kind of, you know, redirect.
So you go at the fundamental level. Okay, so I think Manuel.
So I'm Manuel from UMass. I'd like to come back to the client-server discussions. And actually, when I see all the things you said so far, I would compare you to the automakers of Detroit, and that bigger is better. You are building those big Hummers and gas-guzzling SUVs. And it's like, well, I was relatively happy with the new browsers because I could go to any website and almost do everything for my brother. I could buy something on Amazon. I could check my Facebook account. Like now, if I have a phone, basically I need to install a native app for everything. And I absolutely hate that. I mean, I would like just my cell phone to just be a display of whatever website I want to go to and not have to install an app for everything. And so it's like really pushing everything on the client side, the solution, and building more and more on the client and being more and more specialized, the best thing to do. What's the problem with doing everything on the server side and just basically having, I don't know, maybe just client on my cell phone? Is that because the phone companies are charging too much for the data that needs to be sent over if I'm just using X, or what's the problem there? So I'd like to have your take on that.
Thank you. Who wants to take this? Patrick, you're smiling. You have skin in the game.
No, that reminds me, when I was at Sun, there was this, like, you know, the network is a computer, and they had this notion of a network computer that they tried to launch at that time, and it was all based on X, and it didn't work. And I used Sunrays when I was there, and all the processing was done on the server side. And I think this train has left the station. It's like there's no going back to that. Now, if you consider HTML or HTML5 like based apps as your equivalent to that, that would be the I would say, the lowest common denominator type of apps that you can build. And I think in the enterprise world, a lot of these apps are going to move there. To give you an example, like a real-life example, recently a friend of mine who's building apps for corporates, he built them a full reporting app in the cloud and all that with a very fancy UI. And he built that using GWT, where you build it in Java, you compile it to JavaScript and HTML. So they had a web app version of it. And then he did a little skin, a different CSS skin, where he had all the controls look like iPhone controls, smaller screen and all that. And one day, they had to present the app to the board, and the CEO of the company said, OK, your app is really cool, but I want that to work on my phone. And then they just had to say, hey, we have it already. Just load it on your phone, and it's working. And the UI was not completely iPhone-like, but enough for a corporate app that people were happy with it. So I think in the corporate world, it's going to go that way. Now, for consumer type of apps, things like Flipboard or Twitter, I really love to have a really fancy, completely new type of UI and play with that as a consumer. And I think these guys are going to continue pushing the envelope using native.
Anybody wants to add anything? We touched on this before.
OK. So John?
So I wanted to provoke you on a different topic. I'd like to come back to the word synchronization, which was mentioned, I think, in the opening statements. So the word synchronization to me already has sort of 1980s kind of implications to me. I think it means you're assuming a disconnected world where you go offline and work, and then you have to come back and synchronize your data with the mothership. So isn't that just fundamentally wrong for today? Aren't we moving to a world, aren't we almost at a world where you are connected 100% of the time? And I realize it's not quite 100% today, but wouldn't we be better off using our intelligence and creativity to make sure you are connected 100% of the time, rather than trying to design applications for a disconnected world, which is just fundamentally more complicated and confusing for users. There's no way to eliminate sort of the user confusion in that world. So why do we talk about synchronization? Isn't this just sort of a bad idea?
No local cache, basically.
No, that's okay. Caching is different than synchronization, I think. Synchronization implies somehow that I could be disconnected.
So my data is always on the server. Access it from there. Okay.
I want my Memex. It's from the 50s, not the 80s.
So I think I would turn your question around. For me, even if you're kind of you're always connected, you still have to deal with different latencies. So your app will have to kind of take that into account. And so I would say that whether you assume that you're always connected or that you're sometimes disconnected. If you're disconnected, you have an extremely high latency. But at some point, you will be connected. So in that sense, you're always connected already. So I think the problem is the same no matter how you look at it.
And I had one aspect about this, which is even when you're connected all the time, you need synchronization. And the example I will take comes from a patent that Apple recently put out related to iCloud, where they explain the new data structures that they're going to use for iTunes synchronization. So in order to let you stream your library and stream your music on your device, because you cannot have everything on there, so you'll have a bit of your music in the cloud, and they have these new data structures where there's holes in it, so they give you some pieces of the music at regular intervals, and then locally the app is going to play the beginning while streaming the rest of it, and it's going to adjust the intervals based on the average bandwidth that you have that they have measured on the device. That kind of stuff allows you to synchronize maybe a much bigger part of your music library than you wouldn't without synchronization. So I think even in the connected case, you'll want to do synchronization of some sort.
Want to add anything else?
Is anybody willing to argue that disconnected is good? That we should be spending a lot of time on making that work?
Battery life sucks when you're connected to the cloud.
So it goes back to those constraints, right? The device has limited battery, limited power. How do you deal giving good performance
with these constraints.
And my quip at the beginning was when you're saying we're going back to the 80s, I think the disconnected device with all your library on it, it was called the Memex, and it's in a memo from Vannevar Bush from the 40s or 50s. I think we're going to implement that model in the future.
Okay, so I think we have about 4 or 5 minutes. What I want to do is give you guys a chance for parting words. We touched on many different subjects, many different things, but try to keep it to 1-2 minutes max. And think of the students here that are wanting to learn from you, not just category theory. That's the message. If that's the message, that's okay. But what can they do, for instance, if they wanted to come knock at your door and get a job or build their own company? What's your advice, you know? From that space, they are doing web apps. They are trying to innovate. So, who wants to start? Eric.
So I think John Osterhout had a couple of really good questions, and I think this is for me the important thing: is always kind of look at things from all the sides. Never kind of take something for granted. And the world keeps changing, and so if you kind of attack a problem from many different directions, that's the only way you can understand it. And things are never the same, so you always have to adapt. And if you get that, that skill to kind of look at things from different directions and you can switch like within a microsecond, that's how you survive. Otherwise you're a dinosaur. So you have to be a microbe, and be able to change,
Don't accept the status quo also.
Yep.
Okay. Patrick.
Yeah, my main advice for students would be just be curious. You're going to learn all your life, and you need to learn how to learn. That's the main thing you're going to learn in university. And while you're at university, focus on the basics of computer science, data structure, algorithms, like read NUT and try to get some very good fundamentals. Now, in terms of the
web
technology
apps.
Discussion and web apps, I think this is a booming area. We're in an innovation phase, and it's the most fun time to be a programmer because you can tinker with many different ways of doing things. It's very Darwinian out there. There are new apps like stealing market share every day. Like actually Twitter and Flipboard are a good example. I think we're ranked correctly here in terms of evolution.
You're the old guy also.
I know. Google, Twitter, Flipboard, and you guys will sit there next year.
Let me take my rightful place. 100 years old, yes. Rafi?
I mean, both these guys are right. I think it's being able to pivot on the microsecond is incredibly important. Understanding fundamentals are really important. In order to catch someone's eye, I don't think it has necessarily anything to do with the framework you choose, right? It's understanding what the user, understanding users and understanding what they really want. And like I hate to pimp our own product, but like Twitter has absolutely nothing to do with the web when it fundamentally comes down to it. And it's all about just like figuring out exactly how to engage the user and capturing that attention.
Just specifically about web apps, take the time to understand how web browsers work. There are actually very, very few people who take the time to look at the internals of web browsers and how they actually work. If you're working on frameworks and applications, you need to understand the platform you're working with. And understanding how they work is vital to that and helps you figure out, sort of going back to what they said, is challenge assumptions about what people say can and cannot be done. I mean, a few weeks ago, I just saw Fabrice Ballard released a x86 emulator that runs in JavaScript in a browser. Excepting Chrome, and I'm just kidding. And just understand how things work, because browsers are not magic, just like compilers are not, just like how operating systems are not. And it's key to really learning and understanding. You'll really see all the cool things that happen underneath the JavaScript layer.
Thank you, Charles. Appreciate everybody to come. So just to clarify, why did they say I'm 100 years old? I'm from IBM. And we just turned 100 years old today. So, thank you. But thank you for coming. I appreciate it.